Birds are such a wonder to see and to hear. Even if you're just listening to what's around you when you're out running errands or working in the garden, there's so much to take in. But how do we know what we're hearing? As is the case for most holidays, we have two expert and passionate bird watchers with us to share their love and knowledge of birds. Noel Cutright is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Noel, as always, thanks so much for spending your holiday with us.
Well, I'm always happy to be with you, and I hope all the listeners are staying cool today.
Yes, that's not an easy task today,
no,
is it?
Not.
And Bill Volkert has been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years. He spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh. Bill, always a pleasure to have you with us, too.
Well, thanks. Great to join you.
So we have a lot to talk about, and I want to make sure that people know they can join in the conversation by calling 1-800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dave Potraz, our on-air producer today, will get those calls into us. And you can also send an email to talk@wpr.org. So as I said in the introduction, for many birds, May is the time for migration and arrival. June is the nesting season. And now July that we're in is the fledging season when the young are starting to leave the nest. What actually goes on with fledging, Noel? What do the parents do to encourage the young birds, or are they like teenagers who can't wait to get out of the house?
They're all geared to leave when the time comes. And, of course, each individual selects that time, but for most birds, it's part of their inherited traits that when they get to be a certain age, certain size, they're ready to fledge on their own. And of course, you know, some species don't spend any time in the nest after the eggs hatch. They're out and running right away. For example, turkeys. They hit the ground running when they're, it's called precocial. Many, like killdeer, are the same way. You'll notice little killdeer running around when they're only just a few inches high. So once those eggs hatch, they're on the go. But for most, you know, most of our birds that we're familiar with, they'll have a period in the nest from a couple weeks to 3 weeks, depending on the species.
And Bill, do most birds nest just once per season, or are there a significant number that actually have more than one brood?
Yeah, it depends a little on the species. Some birds, like the waterfowl, turkeys, grouse, pheasants, they'll raise a single family in a year. However, if the nest is destroyed during the nesting period, they will commonly re-nest. So right now you might drive around the marshes and the shallows of the lake shores and see ducks with half-grown young or nearly full-grown at this point for very early nesters, or you might see some where I came across a brood just yesterday. They look like they're 3 days old. Probably a re-nesting. Something happened, and they decided to try one more time. And what you'll notice, especially for ducks, is as they try a second time, the female has used a lot of her energy in that first production egg. She doesn't have as much energy reserves or as much time to build them up, so that second clutch will be smaller.
Okay.
And they will try sometimes a third time, but at that point they've used up an awful lot of energy. It's kind of an exception, or they just give up because it's getting too late in the season.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our songbirds will have two, and for things like the bluebird, three clutches occasionally, mourning doves even more than that if they start early enough in the year. So it depends on the species, but a lot of our songbirds will have just a single family. And this makes it a real challenge because here we've got long-distance migrants. They go all the way down into the tropics, come up here, have a chance to raise a single family, and if anything happens, they've got to go all the way back and try again the next year. And we also find that for a lot of the warblers, for example, the real successful males are the 2- and even 3-year-olds. So it's not just a matter of successfully raising young, but also surviving long enough so that you can finally pull off a family to replace yourself by the time their time has expired.
Now, you were talking about the female birds especially expending a lot of energy in producing the eggs and tending the young. Is this an important time for us to be feeding birds in the summer? And if so, are there any guidelines we should be following?
Well, actually, summer right now, we're at the height of the food. And this is the idea of bird nesting. Birds are not arriving on the nesting grounds when the food is most available, but the idea is that the young are hatching when the food is most available. And so, like, for example, our Canada geese that are migrating to Hudson Bay, they will leave out of here the third week of April, get up to Hudson Bay, it's still frozen and covered with snow, and almost starve themselves, living off of the body reserves of the food they gathered in Wisconsin, waiting for the snow to melt, then to lay the eggs. And as soon as the young hatch, now you have that Arctic spring. As far as feeding them, it's kind of a convenience. There is so much natural food out there for the birds right now, and they really don't need it. And we've talked about this in the past programs. Wintertime, even there, it's a quick stop for birds. We do most of the feeding for ourselves, but it can't get them through the harsh, severe storms. The nice thing in summertime, though, is I've got my feeders up, and I just watched a family of downy woodpeckers come through.
Wow.
And, I've got orioles coming here with their young now. We have a chance to actually bring those families close to the house where we can observe them. Otherwise, they're hidden back in the dense foliage and mm-hmm. oftentimes go unobserved.
Noel, did you want to add something?
Yeah, orioles are especially interesting this time of year, and people that have grape jelly out for them, as the young get older in the nest, the adults will come in, try to gather beaks full of jelly and transport it to the nest. And you can imagine that's quite a bit of a challenge because
right.
jelly doesn't hold together real well.
Especially in hot weather.
Especially in hot weather when it gets even more runny, I guess. But then when they do fledge, they'll very often come into the feeders, and it's kind of fun to watch them experience grape jelly for the first time.
Oh.
As Bill says, right now woodpeckers will come in the grape jelly and bring their youngsters in. And youngsters this time of year look really drab and gray and look pretty motley looking, but it's that's one of the reasons, again, we've talked about, as Bill mentions, why we feed is mm-hmm. for our enjoyment, but they can certainly do just fine without putting food out for them.
Now, for the grape jelly feeders for the orioles and you were just saying woodpeckers too, is there a particular kind of feeder that we should go out and buy, or is there something we can rig up ourselves?
I say cheaper the better.
Okay.
just a lid of any kind, a chowl.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I used to use baby food jars when I had babies around the house.
Mm-hmm.
So any kind of chowl container that you can anchor down so it doesn't move on a surface where the birds can perch and get it. But, yeah, you can also buy more attractive feeders, so it's really up to your choice.
I think the biggest precaution, though, for summer feeding is don't put as much food out as you might in winter. It doesn't keep as long. The birds are not as demanding on the food, so it's not going to go as quickly. And especially when we have high temperatures, high humidity, there's a chance of spoilage.
Because of the oils in the seeds, I'm assuming.
Yeah, and well, especially with the seeds, the chance for fungus to grow there. And the aspergillosis fungus does lead to potential disease, what we call an avian pneumonia.
Mm.
It gets into the windpipe, so to speak.
So maybe not filling up the feeders, but filling them more or adding seeds more often.
Exactly. And when you're out there to refill them, make sure you wash them and clean them up good, just so we are not contaminating anything. Obviously, we want to attract the birds and enjoy them. We don't want to expose them to some
sure.
dangers.
Now, one of the things we've been doing the last couple of shows is trying to use some audio of bird calls and bird songs. And since we were just talking about orioles, and since I happen to have audio of Baltimore Orioles here, let's take a listen to that. So were you two able to hear that?
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh,
great. Great. And so what stands out, let's start with you, Noel. What stands out to you about the Baltimore Oriole song?
It's a very clear whistle that they give, but it is quite variable. Individuals, there are some that are so boring, they just give the same couple of notes time after time after time after time, where other individuals are, you know, give quite varied songs. So it takes a little use to experience to be able to recognize orioles, just because individual variation is quite a lot. But, they do have a very clear whistle that varies a lot in pitch.
And Bill, did you have anything to add to that?
Well, I agree with Noel. It has that real clarity to the whistle. And I was thinking of it as they're just real positive. They're just pumped up. There's just something about it. They're very cheery with that whistle. But as Noel said, quite variable. So you get more used to the quality of the voice than just, say, the rhythm, because it's not repeated between individuals very often.
All right. You're listening to The Larry Miller Show. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry on this 4th of July. Larry is actually on the Wisconsin Public Radio Garden Tour of England. They're in London and Southeast England. And we have a bunch of great photos up. Larry's been faithfully emailing them to me, and I've been getting them up on our Facebook page. Also, Matthew, who is the group leader from Earthbound Expeditions, the company that we worked with for this tour, has been sending some photos too. So you can go to that. You don't have to be a member of Facebook to see them. Just go to The Larry Miller Show, and it's M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Miller spelled M-E-I-L-L-E-R, and there's some great photos, and they're all wearing jackets and long pants. It looks lovely, I have to say. Nobody looks like they're, you know, sweating out of their clothes. So they're having a wonderful time. Looks like good food, great gardens, and a really fun group. So we'll be posting photos throughout the week.
Maybe
and
we should have signed up for it.
I know. Well, you know, they have to leave the really talented people behind. That's what I've been telling myself. So we have several people who would like to join the conversation. So let's go to the phones and May in Reedsburg. Hi, May. Hello.
Hello. I'm calling. I had originally called because I wanted to know something about hummingbirds, but listening to your talk about orioles, I wanted to tell you that I have one of these shepherd's crooks right outside my kitchen window about, maybe a foot away, and I put an oriole feeder out there, and both the orioles and the hummingbirds feed off from that, and they some of them actually bump into my kitchen window because they get too close. The other, what I wanted to ask about the hummingbirds, I want to know how I have hummingbirds come back here in the spring, and if the feeders aren't there, they sit up in the, I have a snowball bush where I used, that I generally put a feeder in, and they sit there and wait for the feeder to be put up. And I know they are the same ones. They have to be the same ones who had been here the year before. Have you ever tried banding a hummingbird and seeing what they are doing?
Sure, that's a great question, May. And Bill, is banding hummingbirds something that's done commonly?
Not real commonly. I've been a licensed master bird bander for the past 30 years, and I've caught thousands of birds. Hummingbirds, I will get in the net occasionally, but because of the extremely tiny legs that they have, it's a very special little band, little size X that they call it. They reserve it just for them. Hmm. And here's the problem. If I were to band hummingbirds, as I do, you know, just as a matter of course, I may get one or two in spring in the net in any year. One year we had a very unusual cold morning. I caught a dozen of them, and that was the first time in 30 years. But overall, I might in, say, 5 years, barely get a handful of hummingbirds. And with the low amount of returns that we get on some of these birds, because it's hard to catch the same bird again, it's hardly even worth my time or effort. So I really don't band them myself. Now, there is a couple down in Louisiana that focuses on just hummingbirds. That's all they do. And I had read where they're set up a station. They're getting 600 to 800 individuals and huge amounts of data. And this is the trick about banding. You've got to literally band hundreds of birds to get a few returns and start to get not only one or two birds coming back, but over the years to understand a little bit of a trend in the population. What are they really doing? So it's a very specialized type of study, and I have not done it. And, you know, unless you really band the birds, it's hard to say whether it's that same individual that's out in your backyard that was there the last year. Certainly banding studies tell us that birds home in very well, and I guess we could assume if they're right there at that same feeder, either it's just plain luck that they stumble across or you got a bird that's really looking for your feeder in your backyard. And I've actually seen this for winter birds, the juncos. I've banded at my feeders. I've had them come back 4 or 5 years in a row, same individual, right to my backyard.
Wow.
So they are pretty exact in that way. But, you know, again, unless you really mark them, it's hard to know who's mm-hmm. who, since for any species, they all look alike.
Noel?
Yeah, hummingbird banders tend to be really focused on hummingbirds, and the general banders like Bill and Al Sherko, who bands at River Edge, and other folks usually don't have the capabilities to band hummingbirds. But down at Hilton Pond Nature Sanctuary down along in the coastal area of Virginia, they band a lot of birds, and they're actually doing some color marking of birds, and they're getting sightings down on the Gulf Coast, and they actually take people down, and they band ruby-throated hummingbirds in the fields down in Costa Rica in the wintertime, and they actually have gotten a couple of band recoveries of birds between both the wintering areas and the summering areas. So we know pretty certain now that hummingbirds do return to the same locations for breeding and for wintering, and I would expect that many of these will stop in the same locations year after year during migration also.
Great. Thanks for that call, May. And speaking of banding, I'm really looking forward to doing one of the Natural Resources Foundation field trips in October, I believe it is. I'm going to be helping band saw-whet owls.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, I can't wait. And actually, I'm going on one of their field trips this Saturday for looking at prairie birds, flowers, and butterflies, so out in Blue Mountains. So that should be a lot of fun. Thanks for that call, May. And let's go to Jilly and Wanderers. Hi, Jilly.
Hi, good day, and thank you. Actually, I spoke with you on Memorial Day, and the update is that no martins did return to our Maple Ridge Martin House, but there's always next year, and we're not giving up. My question is, bluebirds and popcorn. Someone who knew someone who had read it in a magazine give bluebirds popcorn. So that weekend, we popped the corn and set it out, no butter or salt. The next day, the popcorn was gone, and while we were checking the nest, my stomach fell to the ground and my face in my hands. We had killed the baby birds. There was no sound, no heads turning up. But wait, there were heartbeats and they were still alive. Now, one would think that parents would not feed anything that would be harmful to their offspring. And before I get off and listen to your response, I just wanted to comment that this year in particular, while watching the baby grosbeaks, it hit me that it's so obvious that birds evolved from dinosaurs. It was just beautiful and profound.
Mm. Oh.
And thank you.
Well, thank you, Jilly, and thank you for that update. And let's see what Bill and Noel have to say about the popcorn issue. Noel, do you want to start?
Well, I'm just wondering if she really knows the popcorn was fed to the young birds.
Right. I was wondering that, too.
I mean, a lot of other things could be eating the popcorn other than the adult bluebirds carrying it to the nest. So I'd be very surprised, I guess, to hear that they would carry popcorn to feed their young. I mean, the young are being fed invertebrates, soft insect prey, other types of caterpillars. They do not carry seed and so forth. In fact, that's true for most of the birds that we encounter as youngsters in our area. They're being fed invertebrates, even though the parents for many, many months may be seed eaters. When they're raising young, they're carrying invertebrates, primarily insects, into the nest.
Mm-hmm. So even if the parents picked up the popcorn, they might have eaten it, but they probably didn't feed it to the babies.
And I don't think they ate it either.
Okay.
Personally, that's my opinion. I don't know if Bill shares that or not. But
yeah, it's really not part of their diet, and I'd never heard of popcorn for bluebirds. That's kind of new for me. And as we mentioned earlier, how do we know that it wasn't a raccoon got in there, a squirrel or something else?
Or some kind of disease or parasite or something, yeah. So, Jilly, I think you can rest easy that you didn't have anything to do with the baby bluebirds not doing well. All right. Let's go next to Gloria in Shawano. Hi, Gloria.
Good morning. I have three comments. One is, at the very tail end of the Memorial Day program, a lady called in and said, there's this little bird out here that's smaller than a hummingbird. It's two-tone tan, and there was speculation, was it a kinglet or whatever? I'm wondering if she saw a hummingbird moth, which they can look like little birds.
Mm-hmm, it's true.
Okay, and then my other comment.
That would be an excellent suggestion. It's one that didn't enter my mind at the time, but hummingbird moths do fool people a lot.
Yeah, that's what I thought of when she was describing it as tan and mm-hmm. smaller than a bluebird. My second comment, what I really am calling about is indigo buntings, but you were talking about orioles, and this week I saw something so funny. A female young oriole came, and so did her brother. And she went into the feed me mode by the jelly, and the brother looked at her like, what's the deal? But then he's like, well, I guess I better feed her. And so the brother was feeding the sister. It was just cute.
That's really funny.
But I have to tell you about my feeding indigo buntings. I don't have a ton of them, but I do get one to come pretty consistently. And what I very specifically feed is I have a tube feeder with red millet in it, and I have a tube feeder with white millet. But the key is they do not like being up high. I have them hung very, very low to the ground in some low shrubbery.
Oh.
And that's what gets the indigo buntings to come, is those two. They don't go to the ground feeders where I have the same stuff. They come to those tube feeders that are just hung low in the bushes.
And how do you keep...
Do they still come in the summertime, too?
They do. I'm seeing them.
Wonderful.
I get them to come all summer. And I've been meaning to call, like, for the last 4 bird programs, and it's like, today I'm going to do it. Because people say, how do you get them to come? And that's how, in a tube feeder, hung low in shrubbery stuff.
Yeah, people are able to get them when they first get here in the spring, and they'll come... You know, during, especially when the weather is a little inclement, and of course they want to have them all year round. And usually once they get into the breeding mode, they'll disperse and you'll never get them back at the feeder again. I've never had one, say, during summertime come to my feeder, but of course I do feed white millet, but I tend to put it on the ground. I've never tried to put it into a tube feeder close to the ground. Indigo buntings are kind of interesting because people do see them in the spring, and they're just such a beautiful bird, and they want to have them all year round. And I tell people, where do you live? And if they say any place out in the country, I say, well, you probably have indigo buntings within a mile of your house. And they just can't believe it because they don't recognize them sitting on the wires nearby and singing their distinctive song. But they are with us the entire year throughout Wisconsin.
Bill, what were you going to add?
I was going to say, you may also have them just 50 feet above you, that they're not visiting the feeders, but they rise into the trees. And we mentioned this the previous program. The indigo bunting, once they get up overhead or in that dense foliage, unless you know the song, they're just gone from sight. Actually, this summer, I've got one that's still coming to a feeder, not regularly, but every so often. And I've got them nesting and singing around my house every year. But here's an individual that took to the feeder and keeps coming, even at this time of year. But I think that's like the orioles. Those are individual preferences. I cannot get orioles to eat grape jelly here. I can put it out. They come to my hummingbird feeders, but they will not touch grape jelly. And you'll hear this from different people. Some of them, they can't keep up with them. Others, they won't look at it.
Hmm.
And, you know. You just got to try what's going to work for not only the individual species and their food preference, but sometimes individuals among the population that have a particular habit.
I had my first ever indigo bunting in the backyard this year. And
it was electric blue, isn't it?
It almost brought me to tears. It was so beautiful. So, yeah, that was really a thrill. I'm curious, though, why they would want to feed close to the ground. And if that's the case, how in the world do you keep things like squirrels and chipmunks out of a feeder it's hard enough when they're hanging up high?
Well, I'm of the belief that there is no such thing as a squirrel-proof feeder. There are some that are more squirrel-resistant than others, but that's always going to be a battle. And I've got one with a cage around it. It keeps the gray squirrels out, but the chipmunks and red squirrels still get in, and it also keeps the larger birds out. It just gets tough, and the one thing you don't want to do is to be shelling out 5 pounds of sunflower every day just to feed all the squirrels in the neighborhood. So yeah, you just got to experiment with what's going to work to try to satisfy enough of the birds and keep some of the squirrels at bay. And some feeders are better than others and more squirrel resistant than others.
About the most active location at our place this summer is our bird baths. We have both one in the front and back. And I know everyone in Wisconsin is not as dry as we are here in southeast Wisconsin, but, boy, bird baths this time of year when there's no puddles around and in our community there's no one that's sprinkling their lawns or anything to provide freestanding water. And even all the small little streams and wet areas have dried up now. So putting out water can really be another way to attract birds to your yard.
Right. We are talking about birds, bird watching, and bird listening with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. I'm Judith Sears Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As is the case on most holidays, we are talking about bird watching with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They join us just about every major holiday to talk about birds. And it seems like, you know, even in the summer where we've got Memorial Day, then 4th of July, then Labor Day, we never run out of things to talk about. And I know that Bill can look at Facebook where he is at. There is an amazing photo up on Facebook that Mary posted, a woodpecker eating superworms. A really gorgeous picture. And for those of you that would like to see it, if you go to the Facebook page, that's the Larry Mueller Show, go to the right-hand column where it says recent posts by others, and it's up there. It's really quite a striking picture. So, Mary, thanks so much for sharing that with us.
What is a superworm?
I'm not sure, but it's, I don't know. It looks like a kind of like a mealworm to me. But
probably a mealworm.
Probably a mealworm. But the woodpecker is much more spectacular in the picture than the superworm. So last winter, we enjoyed record numbers of snowy owls, and I know that was a huge thrill for a lot of people in Wisconsin. This summer, it's the dick sissels. And what is a dick sissel, and how do we spot them, Noel?
Well, dick sissel is a bird that's related to cardinals and indigo buntings. They're and even rosebreasted grosbeaks are in that family. So they have a large beak, and they overwinter primarily in northern South America, primarily in Venezuela area. And they one of the last birds to arrive here in the spring. I don't even start thinking about seeing a dick sissel until Memorial Day, even though you can get them a little bit earlier than that, especially in the southwestern part of the state. But they're still migrating into the state through the first half of June, and they like to nest in hay fields, in prairies, grasslands, especially those that have some weeds in them, some forbs. And they have a very distinctive song, which I hope you will play here in a
yes.
couple of minutes. But they're very nomadic breeding species. You know, some years are quite common here in Wisconsin. Other years, you have to hunt for one. But this year, we have had one recorded, except for maybe Menominee County, which is has no open fields at all. They've been recorded in every county in Wisconsin, from Milwaukee to Douglas, to Door, to Grant County. And they're just persistent singers. They'll sing from fences along the roadsides. Because they will nest actually in ditches along and woody or not in grassy weedy roadside ditches. They'll nest, so they're very noticeable along the roadsides. They have a yellow breast, a black bib, which is right beneath a white chin. They kind of have a rusty wing patch, so they're a little bit larger than a sparrow, but they'd be smaller than a red-winged blackbird that you often see perched along the road. But they're just flooded the area this year. They've a species that's declined a lot in the state. One thing that was noticed a number of years ago, they tend to have like a six-year cycle for some reason, where every sixth year you get a large number. During the Breeding Bird Atlas, we had a kind of a peak in 1998, so the next one should have been like in 2004 or 2005, and here we are 2012, just about 6 years later, and we just They're just everywhere, and it's a spectacular time to get out and enjoy dick sissels.
Well, and as you said, we do have some audio of that, so let's listen to the dick sissel now. It really is a very distinctive call.
Yeah, I have a hard time hearing the first part of that. I can hear the kind of the chip note. But, they do say dick sissel. So just like Phoebes and a few of other species, they actually sing their name.
And, Bill, have you been seeing a lot of dick sissels this year?
Yeah, this is a banner year. And for people who are not familiar with dick sissel, here's my recommendation. If you're out in the countryside, as Noel said, they love the open fields and farmlands and abandoned fields, so it's a grassland bird. And if it's not too hot out there, drive with the window open, and they'll be sitting up on the wire or perched up on some tall plants out in the field, and just listen for that distinctive song. If you have the chance, take your binoculars with you and get a good look at the bird. This is the year to find them. And as Noel indicated, they're here every year, but they're very nomadic, and But this is a year where they've just shown up everywhere. There's also a very interesting conservation concern with Dick Sissels. In the North American prairies and farmlands, they're insect eaters, but in wintertime, they gather in massive flocks, and they become seed eaters. They go down to central Venezuela, a place called the Llanos, which is the flats. It's a huge area of grassland and wetland in this north-central part of Venezuela. The entire world population goes down into the western part of the Llanos and forms flocks of hundreds of thousands to even a million birds.
Wow.
Problem is they hit the rice grain and sorghum crops down there, and so the farmers have been quite upset about crop damage.
Mm-hmm.
And a number of years ago, there was even an effort of a few people to do aerial spraying of a pesticide.
Yeah.
And the conservationists realized very quickly with this high concentration that a single person could take out 5% or more of the entire world's population with that kind of spraying. So they're trying to look at more sustainable ways of compensation, because a million birds show up in your crop field,
sure,
you're sure you're going to have problems. It'll be a hardship for someone. But how can we balance that with the need to protect these birds? And it's just unusual that they're so dispersed and very nomadic on the breeding grounds, and yet in winter, they crowd in these massive flocks.
Mm.
We had a chance to see some of them when we were in Venezuela a number of years ago, and very extraordinary migration.
And they have been successful in trying to come up with other ways to help the farmers out down there. And I think at least even the last few years, just not counting this year, I've seen greater numbers of Dick Sissels. So maybe some of our efforts in their wintering grounds has been successful. We're kind of on the western edge of their breeding range here in the United States. They're much more common out in the prairie states. But they also seem to have adapted to what some people might call secondary habitats. They're away from the natural grasslands and savannas, and they're now breeding in weedy fields. And of course, one of the problems, they get here in early June and start breeding and nesting, and then the hayfield is cut or is harvested, and so they get disrupted a lot. In the Forest Beach Migratory Preserve in northern Ozaukee County, it seems like all the Dick Sissels and nearby hayfields all flooded into that area once the hayfields were cut. And we estimated on about 100 acres, we had almost 60 Dick Sissels. And they were all saying, you couldn't stand anywhere on the property, not hear a Dick Sissel.
Not hear one, wow.
And being such a late arrival in Wisconsin, just barely showing up, as Noel says, as we get into June, trying to attract the mate and then set up shop and get ready for nesting, we need fields that are entirely abandoned from any sort of farming practices, because any hay cutting during that whole month of June is certainly going to disrupt the nesting cycle for them. So here was a bird that did fairly well when cows were more pastured and there were some uncut fields, or we rotated crops,
mm-hmm,
or fallow fields. But under the more intensive farming, it gets a little tougher. They get lured into these sites, and then, of course, things have to be harvested just as they're setting up and getting into the nesting season.
And if you look at the Wisconsin Breeding Bird Atlas map, which was produced from field work done from 1995 through the year 2000, there's about a dozen counties where we didn't even find any, and that's 6 years. And to have them now in every county in the state this year is just, I can say it's amazing, especially up north, even in Florence and Forest, some of those counties you don't think of as having grasslands. I was in northwestern Minnesota this last week. They're appearing almost all the way up into that area also.
Wow.
So it's just a grand year to get out there to see them.
We're talking bird watching and bird listening with Bill Volkert. I always want to make you guys one person and switch up your names. Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry Mueller. And let's go back to the phones. Kay in New Auburn is next. Hi, Kay.
Hi. Chickadees raised a family in a birdhouse. Should the nest material be cleaned out or left alone?
You can go ahead and clean it out if you'd like. Some people don't, and they might reuse the nest, but I would go ahead and clean it out now.
Okay, but they've, after they all left, now I see, a couple of them are coming back and sitting on top of the birdhouse, so.
They'll sit on top, but as Noel mentioned, once they're out of the nest, they don't go back in the nest. And as Noel indicated earlier, ducks, geese, turkeys, they hatch, they dry out, and walk away from the nest and never come back. Songbirds, they have that period as immatures, being born or hatched out, basically blind and naked. They then mature in the nest, But as soon as they've got their flight feathers, they're out. And while they may perch around that site, because they're not able to fly very far, they're not reliant on the nest. In fact, birds want to get out of that nest as fast as possible, because the longer you hang out there, the more vulnerable you are to being found by a predator.
Yeah, they left quite a while ago, you know.
So feel free to clean out the nest. It may also be a chance to get rid of any residual parasites that may be in the nesting material and have them start over again.
Okay, thank you.
Sure.
Thanks, Kay. And while we're on the phones, let's go to Krista in River Falls. Hi, Krista.
Hi. I'm calling because I saw something this morning that I've never seen before. My husband and I were out walking along the Kinnikinnick River here in town, and there were teeny little feathers drifting down from the top of a tree like cottonwood. And I'm wondering if we were seeing some molting, or I don't know. What do you think was going on there?
Bill?
I'm going to wait for Bill to answer this one.
There is this molting of the down feathers as birds get that first plumage. That's a possibility. Could be also from feather mites and shedding the feathers. I don't know if Noel has another guess.
That's what came to my mind, too, is that when they leave the nest, they will molt their down. But, of course, down really doesn't look too much like feathers.
Okay.
What were the sizes of the feathers?
They're really tiny. They definitely have a feather structure length, I'd say half an inch, very delicate. Hmm. I've got a couple in my hand here right now.
And how many were you seeing?
Oh, my. It was coming down pretty steady. In the time we were walking by, I'd say 20.
Hmm. Normally when birds replace their feathers, when they go through a molt, it's a very slow process, one at a time, a couple at a time, and they're just dropping them. Then commonly when they take off, they'll flutter the feathers and ruffle them a bit, and a few will maybe shed from there. Now, birds can actually drop feathers very quickly, and I know when I'm banding birds sometimes,
yep.
We'll get a bird that gets quite agitated, and as we release it, they'll actually drop some of their wing or tail feathers, and this is what we call a fright molt. It's basically a defense. If they're grabbed by a predator, they can shed those and still get away, kind of like a lizard where the tail breaks off and, you know, the predator is left with the tip of a tail.
Or kind of like a cat at the vet.
But to be perched and to be shedding them like that under stress, I have no good explanation for it.
Now, would those downy feathers maybe have been part of nest material and maybe a nest got disturbed?
Well, only a few birds actually use feathers in the nest. Ducks, geese, especially the eider ducks, are certainly well known for it. And tree swallows will take it into the nest. And I've already had tree swallows where they may gather a few feathers, perch, and then drop a few for whatever reason, whether it's just being a little clumsy or careless or being frightened. But this seems like a mystery.
Hmm. Well, Krista, sorry we couldn't help you more, but it sounds like an interesting thing to have seen.
It does. Once in a lifetime, maybe.
There you go. Well, thank you.
On the 4th of July.
There you go. Maybe it was fireworks
maybe
of some
kind.
All right. Well, thanks for that call, Krista. And let's go right to David in Franklin. Hi, David.
Hi there, Judith. Kind of along the lines of listening to birds and hearing birds, on June 11th, I live on a ridge top, and I was out on the balcony out there, and I could hear some real heavy wing beats, and usually that's just some geese flying by kind of low at the ridge top, but this was extremely loud, and I looked up, and there it was four whooping cranes. So I thought, okay, I'm probably wrong about that, so I went to the eBird site, and I found out that, yeah, sure enough, there's a group of them that was moving around central Wisconsin around that time, and it was just kind of odd that they made so much noise with their wings.
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of astounding. So
wow. So whooping cranes, and this was in Franklin.
Yes.
Wow.
Just on the edge of Whitnall Park.
Wow. So Bill or Noel, that seems awfully unusual to me.
Well, the whooping cranes, of course, are part of an intentional reintroduction and release program. Whooping crane was one of the most endangered birds in North America. In the 1940s, we were down to about 15 individuals. The entire world's population was in a single group of birds going from Texas up to central Canada. And the fear was if anything should happen to that one population of birds, even with a good recovery after 50 years, they're still vulnerable. You've basically got all your eggs in one
sure.
basket. There's been a number of experiments that try to start a second population. I won't go through the whole history, but they tried out in Idaho, down in Florida, a non-migratory population. And, of course, the ones that they're more or less hand-rearing and then training with concealed caretakers with basically puppets to look like the
right.
adults so they don't imprint on people, and then we'll fly them behind ultralights. So that's been fairly successful. We've been slowly building up the Wisconsin population. And we do have these wanderers in the population because large birds like this will not mature and nest until they're around 4 or 5 years old. So we've got a lot of these wanderers, these juveniles, moving around. And here is a bird that was so rare in North America and Wisconsin with the introduction. We've got a chance to see them, not only the site where we're intentionally releasing them, which was Nisida and now moved to Horicon and to the White River Marsh area, but these juveniles and the roamers out there. And Franklin, you wouldn't expect to see a whooping crane flock down there, but good for him. That was fantastic.
Yeah, that must have been quite an experience, David.
Yeah, it was. And like I say, they were extra loud with their wings.
So you knew there was a significant bird flying over.
Yeah, I just
over.
Looked up and waited. I knew something was coming.
That's amazing. Wow. Well, congratulations on that, because that really is an unusual sighting. And, of course, we should mention that the International Crane Foundation right in Baraboo has done tremendous work, not just with the whooping cranes, but with cranes of all types.
Absolutely.
And let's go to Shauna and Gillette next. Hi, Shauna.
Good. Hello.
Hi.
I don't have a question. What I have is a short anecdote about something that happened to me in early spring. I live in rural Gillette, so I was coming from town, and for one time, I didn't have my camera with me. I wished I had. But anyway, I passed this field of cows. Some of them had calves with them, some nursing. And on the far end of the field was one cow that had a calf laying on its side next to her. She was maybe 20, 25 feet away from the calf and just standing there chewing her cud. And I wondered if the calf was alive or dead. And the second that hit my mind, a vulture swooped down and stood next to the calf. And it was like, it happened so lightning fast that it was just amazing to me. The cow bent her head down like a bull does, ready to charge, and actually charged the vulture and butted him in the air.
Wow.
I was going fast, and there was a lot of traffic behind me. There was no way I could stop and watch it or even to turn around. It was impossible to turn around and go find the aftermath. But it was the most awesome thing I've ever seen with a bird.
And was the calf then dead? Did it ever move?
I don't know. I couldn't go back.
Wow.
I had a line of traffic behind me, and I'll always wonder, did it
I almost
it?
Expect to even lure the vulture in and tempt them. You know, vultures are obviously very big birds. They soar and sail. They're not real powerful flyers, and their big concern is, yeah, their food's on the ground. They're looking for something dead to scavenge. But once they're on the ground, they're pretty vulnerable. And for it to come in, be that tempted, and actually get butted, there must have been a pretty tempting meal there, I would expect. It wasn't just inspecting.
Not a future meal, but a present meal.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah. Well,
the thing was, the calf and the cow were set apart sort of from the herd. They were on the northern edge of the field, and possibly the vulture thought they were very vulnerable.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for that story. That's really a fascinating story. Lots of people with amazing bird sightings. We're talking about bird watching and bird listening with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Noel is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology, and Bill Volkert is a wildlife educator and a naturalist. He worked for many years at the Horicon Marsh International Education Center. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, sitting in today for Larry Mueller. Talking about birds and bird watching with Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. And if some of you are in front of computers, either now or later, you can take a look at some great pictures up on the Facebook page. There is a picture of what Mike thinks is an orchard oriole. He lives near New London, and he's wondering about that. There's also a great picture of an indigo bunting on a feeder. And Joy Cardine, our 6 to 9 a.m. host on the Ideas Network, posted a photo of a squirrel looking inside a porch door with the caption, "Hello, the bird wants me to tell you that the feeder is empty." So thanks for that, Joy. And I think, unfortunately, that is a lot of us feel like we are feeding squirrels and an occasional bird comes by to enjoy some of what's out there. So thanks so much to all of you for sharing those photos. Mike in New London is up next. Hi, Mike.
Hi there.
And that's your photo, right?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Just want to tell you, I love the show, and I believe I've got these orchard orioles coming to my feeder, but I'm interested. I've not heard people talk about them. I didn't hear the whole show today. I missed part. I know you talked orioles. Is it possible I've got orchard orioles?
And, Bill, you can see the photo, right?
Yes.
And what do you think?
Looks to be, it's quite backlit, so the background's quite bright, but from what I'm seeing, it's kind of squinting at it here to see the detail of the color. It's a little smaller than the Baltimore Oriole would be. And the orchard oriole is a bird that, 15, 20 years ago, was somewhat uncommon, I guess, in Wisconsin. It's a more southern population, but it seems that they've been moving north, and where I considered it somewhat of an infrequent sighting. Some of these are coming back year after year at people's places. It looks like we've got a much better established population. And I think these days we've got better chances of actually seeing orchard orioles in Wisconsin than we did a number of years ago.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Mike, and thanks for sharing that photo. We had an email from John and Patricia. They said, "We're fascinated by the story of the first modern confirmed nest record for bufflehead in Wisconsin and are wondering if they came back to Horicon this year." Bill?
They were sighted back there on the marsh. I don't know if there's been any confirmed nesting of them so far for the year.
As a week ago, no.
Yeah.
Okay.
I hadn't heard anything since.
And can you describe buffleheads a little bit for people who aren't familiar with them?
Yeah, it's one of our tiny diving ducks. It's an extraordinary bird, pure white with this. It looks from a distance like black and white on the head, but it's actually a greenish purple iridescent.
Oh.
Pretty little thing. They're a cavity nester, and we watched that bird out at Horicon for 2 years. And in fact, I published an article in the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology journal about our observation and a bunch of different tests that we tried to confirm it. And here we had last year two birds nesting on the marsh in wood duck boxes. This is a bird that should be nesting 500 miles north of here, in central Canada. So they should not even be nesting in Wisconsin. And we're still watching a male in June, May and June, and then we suspected that perhaps there were birds in the box actually nesting. And one of the nest boxes was right out the front windows of the education center, right where we led our hikes daily, and we never saw her go in and out.
Hmm.
They're amazingly secretive. And the only way to really be sure of it is to open up the box and take a look, or as I had one of my staff do, take a canoe out there, paddle around, and just reach in the box with a little digital camera and shoot some pictures down. And sure enough, we were able to confirm that they're in there. But, you know, here are birds, when you've got a dozen or more wood duck boxes out there, they may be occupying any of them, and you can't just stand there and watch them come
sure.
and go.
Well, and speaking of wood duck boxes, Karen from Edgerton emailed, "Our wood duck has abandoned her house this year, and we saw at least two broken eggs in the nest. Last year, there was a successful brood of 12 that fledged from that house. I was lucky enough to see the adorable plunges. Because this year she was unsuccessful, do you think she'll come back next year to use our house?" What do you think, Noel?
If she doesn't, another one probably will.
Okay.
Very often we have a shortage of cavities for wood ducks, so it sounds like she has it in an excellent location that attracts wood ducks, so I would expect that she'll have wood ducks back again next year.
And would you concur, Bill?
Nest cavities, occasionally we'll also see what we call a dump nest, where we will have nests with 15 to 20 plus eggs in it. This is more than one female dumping the eggs in. And of course, it gets hard to incubate them all. And so putting up multiple boxes can be a nice way to provide for them.
Great. And
can I add a comment about the orchard oriole?
Certainly. Oh, yeah, please do.
When I arrived here in Wisconsin over 30 years ago, orchard orioles were uncommon enough that they were a hotline bird, meaning if you found one, you reported it, and it was put onto a tape recording so other people could go out and find it. So they were that uncommon 30 years ago, but as Bill mentioned, they really have increased in number a lot. If you look at the Atlas map, there were very few found about a third of the way. In the southern third of the state, they were found. In the northern two-thirds, they weren't for the most part. But now that's even changed, and that's why we're thinking about repeating the Atlas starting here in a couple of years. You know, the male is undistinct. You just can't mistake it for anything else because of the rusty brown and the black. But then what's interesting about orchard orioles is that the first-year male really looks more like a female. It's more of a greenish color, but it does have a black bib extending down from the bill, and it sings just as well as an adult male. So you can have two males that sing and can nest but look completely different, which is really kind of unusual in the bird world here in Wisconsin.
And a little challenging for bird watchers, maybe.
Yes. They have a beautiful song. It's much more, it's just kind of a loud burst of whistle notes.
Okay.
But they definitely are around.
And Bill, what were you saying?
Because of those peculiarities, and it's hard to keep all of that in your head, keep a bird book right by your window where you're looking out at the feeder so that when you see either unusual species or these different plumages among the birds like orchard oriole, you can take a look at it and check out on it.
Great. And we have much more to talk about bird watching and bird listening with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright. They join us most holidays here on the Larry Mueller Show to talk about birds. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in for Larry. Stay tuned. Whether we know almost nothing about them or have studied them our whole lives, birds are fascinating. They add to our enjoyment of Wisconsin's great natural areas, not just by sight, but by their sounds as well. We're lucky to have two experts with us today to help us know what we're seeing and hearing. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson sitting in this Independence Day for Larry Mueller. Larry is on the Wisconsin Public Radio Garden Tour of England and looks like he's having a great time. You can see pictures that he and Matthew from Earthbound Expeditions have been sending there up on our Facebook page. That's the Larry Mueller Show, M-E-I-L-L-E-R. Joining us are Noel Cutright and Bill Volkert. Noel is a past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Great to get to talk with you again, Noel.
Yes, I'm really great to be with you too, Judith, and all your listeners.
You know, it's always so much fun, and people really love these bird watching shows, and a big part of them is also Bill Volkert, who's been watching and studying birds for nearly 40 years, and in his travels has sighted more than 2,500 species. That's a quarter of the world's birds. He spent 27 years as a naturalist at Horicon Marsh. Bill, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it's always fun to be able to join you and share with certainly one of our favorite subjects here on birds.
And Noel, we've mentioned how many birds Bill has spotted in his lifetime of watching. Where are you at on your list?
I really have no idea, Judith. I have not had the good fortune of doing much traveling outside of the USA, so most of my list is USA. And as, I guess over time, I've even become a little more focused on spending more time in the area where I live to try to learn more about what's happening on the local scene. So now that I'm retired, I don't have the advantage of kind of adding on to professional meetings I used to go to or other types of meetings and stay and bird in California or Florida or some of these other locations.
Right.
So I do keep a life list for the USA, but I don't even know what that list is now. It's been a number of years since I've checked it.
Well, really the emphasis should be not on just quantity birding, but quality, whether that's your own backyard or, you know, your favorite vacation spot.
Well, and I have to say, Noel, I really like that idea of getting to know the places closest to you and really getting that intimate understanding of the cycles of those places that you see and enjoy every day.
Right. And you can... It's nice to be able to talk to people locally. I think you can have an influence on them when they talk about things that's nearby. They come to appreciate more their local area, and I think they're surprised sometimes that they can find some of these birds real close to home. And one of the things we've started here in Ozaukee County is called Treasures of Oz, and we have set aside a day each June where we encourage people to go out to some of the natural areas in Ozaukee County, and there's people there to lead trips and so forth and to teach people about what some of these natural areas are. And it's just a great way for folks here in Ozaukee County to get out and see locations that they had no idea even existed in this small county here in southeastern Wisconsin.
And so, Bill, I wanted to say you've been hearing some birds in your local area that you weren't seeing or hearing there earlier in the season, and you've referred to those as floaters. What is a floater, and what are they doing right now?
Well, what I noticed in a lot of years is, of course, that all that activity during the spring migration, birds are moving through and sorting themselves out. And then as we get into June, that nesting season, they tend to settle down, and you get used to the voices of who's right around the neighborhood. And then every year, it seems late June, early July, somebody will show up in the neighborhood and start singing that I didn't hear over the previous month. And I refer to these as floaters. What I mean, these are sort of that surplus male, probably the first-year males. The example that I had this year was just about a week and a half ago, right below the house for 2 or 3 days, I heard a morning warbler, which I hadn't heard around here at all for this year. And he showed up, sang for a few days, and then there was nothing. And I think what we have are birds that are probably not successful nesters. They weren't able to lure a mate or defend a territory. They're the young ones, I think, for the most part, or it could be one that perhaps something happens to the mate in the nest, and they start to move around. They're now looking for a new territory, trying their luck. It's getting kind of late. They probably aren't going to be able to raise a family this year, but it's good practice for them. And then next year is when they become more successful to, first of all, establish a territory, to get something of sort of a prime, attractive piece of real estate, and perhaps lure a mate and raise a family. And as I mentioned earlier in the program, this is that added conservation concern that a lot of these birds are not real successful breeders until they're 2 years old for songbirds. And, of course, things like cranes, it may take them 4 or 5 years before they mature. So we've got to make sure that not only are birds rearing young and that they survive, but that those adults survive a couple of trips in migration so they can come back and actually not only find a mate, but even avoid predators and raise young successfully to keep the population numbers up.
Yeah, two good examples of floaters. One is peregrine falcons. You know, we know where all the peregrines essentially are nesting in Wisconsin. And if something happens to one of those adults, it's amazing how quick another female or another male will show up at that nest box. So there's birds just going around looking for opportunities. The other one was one that happened to me this June up in Marinette County. As you may remember, we now have Kirtland's warblers, an endangered species breeding in Wisconsin. And this summer especially, we just have a number of males showing up at a location. They're rather habitat restricted. They have very strict habitat requirements, and it seems like we have a number of males in Wisconsin that are searching for females. I had two there in a jack pine stand on a breeding bird survey, and when people went back several days later to try to relocate those birds and maybe even band them, I mean, they were gone, and that's happened several times. They're just moving around, as Bill says, with his morning warbler, looking for a good location or searching for a female that they can hook up with.
And we did a whole segment on the Kirtland's warblers as part of the series of programs we're doing monthly this year for the 40th anniversary of passage of the Endangered Species Act. After the show, I'll put a direct link up to that program in our audio archive so people can listen to it. It's really a fascinating story about,
yes, it is,
about how they've been protected. Well, we have folks that have been waiting patiently to talk with you two, Bill and Noel. So let's go back to the phones. Pat is on the road. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I have a question about a pair of swans that I've seen for 2 years now on a Wisconsin river bottom slough. And they look to be quite a bit larger than tundra swans, which I see every year over on the Mississippi. And right now, those two swans are seem to be hanging out in one spot on the slough. And because of the growth of the water plants, all I can see are their heads when I drive past that spot, and their heads look pink.
And, Bill, do you have any sense what she might be seeing?
Well, if you're seeing pink, that's that orangish, sometimes pinkish color on the bill, kind of a knob above it, that would be the mute swan. There are three species of swans that occur in North America. The tundra swan, used to be called whistling swan, they nest up in the Arctic. So we see them pass through very early in the year, and then coming back very late in November to even early December. The trumpeter swan, like the whooping crane, is being reintroduced, mm-hmm. and we've got an increasing number of those around the state. And mute swan is actually an introduction from Europe, and this is a bird that really doesn't belong here, and so it's a counterpart to our North American swans. And they were brought over originally for some of the largest states out east as kind of a showcase bird and, of course, an escape to the wild. Otherwise, all of the swans are just simply all white with black on the bill. If you're seeing that orangish, sort of pinkish color as a knob above the on the bill, that is the mute swan, the non-native one.
Well, I think sometimes also trumpeter swans, their heads can get a little stained depending on the water they're breeding in. And since she's talking about a slough, I always think of mute swans as being much more of an open water bird, whereas trumpeter swans will definitely nest in sloughs. I've seen them nesting in sloughs along the Mississippi. And I guess I'm leaning maybe more toward a pair of nesting trumpeter swans.
Well, that could be that staining from the sediment.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Well, Pat, if you can get a picture of it, send it to us at talk@wpr.org, either soon or even within a few days, and we will check it out and see what it looks like. Thanks for that call. Let's go to Pat in East Troy. Hi, Pat.
Hi. We're having a monopoly on that name. early in April, because of the early spring, I got my jelly feeders out quickly. I put the jelly in a little plastic cup that comes with commercially produced puddings, and I hang them from the top of my feeder shepherd hooks, and the birds find them. I put quite a number out. This year, the first robin that I saw insisted that he was going to, or she was going to get into that jelly. And the same, apparently same bird, I think it's only one, has been back, a couple of times a week ever since. I think I may have reported this to Bill in a past visit to the station. But right now, I've told this to so many people who look at me like I'm crazy, and I would love it if somebody else has had the same experience.
So basically you want confirmation that it was a robin eating jelly.
Yeah,
okay.
That doesn't really surprise me a lot. There's always birds that will explore, and they find something that they can deal with and handle. They'll keep returning. Recently, we feed jelly and shallow dishes on top of an old swing set that my kids had. We anchored up there with wire on a piece of board. We have a female turkey that's been spending the summer with us, and it was edging along, heading for the grape jelly the other day. But when it put its foot onto the board kind of rotated a little bit, and it scared it off. So we kind of keep a list of bird species that we have seen coming to our jelly feeder, and we thought we were going to add turkey to the list, but she was unsuccessful. Maybe she's tried it since and achieved success. But I guess it doesn't surprise me that a robin has learned to come to your jelly at all.
And Bill, would you agree?
Oh, yeah, and I think this is what we mentioned earlier, one of those cases where it's not typical for the species, but you've got an exceptional individual that just takes on a habit a little bit out of the ordinary. And I think that's, again, one of the surprises of watching birds. You never know what's going to happen with some of them.
Thanks for that call, Pat. And you can say that that two out of two experts agreed with you. And Barbara in La Crosse has a robin question, too. Hi, Barbara.
I was curious to know what might kill baby robins. I had watched a nest off my deck, and the chicks were about 4 days old, and I had gone out shopping. They were fine when I left. When I came back, there was one young that was dismembered on the sidewalk, and then I looked in the nest, and the other one was, its head had been pecked. And do robins do that to their own? There's a lot of grackles and other, you know, meaner-type birds. Plus, it was incredibly hot. Was it stress-related?
Hmm.
And that's but I needed to know. Okay. It really bothered me. It
sure.
made me very sad.
Sure. Thanks for that call, Barbara. Bill, what do you think?
Well, if the head was pecked, that's you've got another bird that's coming in there. House wrens and house sparrows are both known to do that, to reduce some of the competition in the neighborhood. So it sounds like that nest was actually raided. And if you've got a mammal as a predator, they'll usually take the young out of the nest. So you may see actually the nest being tipped or torn a bit from the weight of the mammal, pulling them out. But if it's something that was injured within the nest, sounds to me like another bird doing that.
I would agree, and I've never heard of a robin being a cannibal or doing anything mm-hmm. destructive to young, even of a robin of another nest. They just are not nest raiders at all.
Mm. Thanks for that call, Barbara, and sorry about your experience. I wanted to point out that Michael Leland, who is our WPR news director, it seems like many of my coworkers are chiming in today. Joy Cardine put that very cute squirrel picture up, and Michael Leland took a lovely picture. He takes really wonderful photographs, a picture of two sandhill cranes in silhouette along one of Madison's bike trails early this morning. So that's on the Facebook page. Again, Larry Mueller Show, and go to the right-hand column, click on recent posts by others, and you'll see Michael's really beautiful photo. Thanks for putting that up. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, talking with Noel Cutright and Bill Volker today about birds, sitting in for Larry Mueller while he is on the WPR Garden Tour of England. And let's go back to the phones and Jenny in Tomahawk. Hi, Jenny.
Hello. I would like to tell you two experiences of mine about birds. A hummingbird a few years ago, they said that I had been told by experts that you didn't feed birds even at the very end of August, the hummers, because they might stay around till it was too long and get cold. So I didn't. I had a feeder and I just added a little bit, and then it was the end of August, and so I didn't add any. And a hummingbird was out there, and it flew around and went back and sat, waited, and then it flew around and came and went, sat back. And I thought, well, that's the hummingbird that's been coming here all the time. So went out and put some food in the hummingbird feeder. And the hummingbird went there and had its fill, I guess. And then he came to my kitchen window, which was on the corner with it. It was a big, almost picture-sized window. And he went all the way around the window, just around the frame, where I stood looking out the window. And it went around about at least three, maybe four times, making a square of the window where I could see it. And I know that he was thanking me. I mean, what else would he possibly do that for? And I just felt like the bird really was saying thank you. And another experience I had with little birds that swallows.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it had a nest in our backyard on the clothespost. And every time anybody in my family had seven children, every time anybody went out, that bird would come and dive bomb them. But when I would go out, he would sit on the clothesline, and I would talk to him. He'd turn his head one way, and turn his head another, like he was listening to every word I said and trying to take it all in.
So it sounds like, I mean, Jenny has had some really interesting interactions with birds. Noel, as far as the tree swallow recognizing her, I certainly know that crows, they say, recognize a wide variety of people. Is that pretty common for other types of birds, too?
Yeah, there's no question that birds can recognize something that's in their environment, and they become used to what they're familiar with. And you can really upset them by introducing something that's strange into their environment. Last night I watched My Life as a Turkey. I would recommend that DVD for people. It's appeared on the Nature series on PBS. But it's just wonderful about the person raising wild turkey chicks in Florida and the relationship. This person, they were imprinted on him because he hatched them out. The relationship that man and a bird can establish is just fascinating with many, many different species. And I have no question that that those tree swallows recognize her. And you hear stories all the time about birds waiting for the purple martin box to go up or someone opening up their bluebird box. And I think there is that relationship.
That's really great. And Bill, have you had relationships like that, experiences like that?
We're getting personal now. I'll tell you an interesting experience. There was a fellow who was doing some banding of red-winged blackbirds around some ponds on the UW Fond du Lac campus. And here you've got students and large numbers of people passing by all day long, but because he was harassing and molesting these birds by right around the nest in the territory, they could pick him out of the crowd of literally hundreds of people and mob him. So they knew who was getting in the nest and posing, at least as they saw it, a potential threat. Going back to the comment about the hummingbirds, this has been a matter of dispute for some time, and I think we talked about this a number of months ago. Should we take down the feeders? Because the fear is that if we keep the food up in September, October, we'll keep the birds here. The hummingbirds will not migrate because there's food. The trigger for migration has nothing to do with shortages of food. They anticipate that. It's the shortening of the day length. They can't wait till the food runs out and then hope to get enough energy and leave. It's birds that may fail to migrate hang around that late. So, yeah, that has been a matter of concern for a while, or a matter of debate. But, no, don't worry about it. There's other environmental signals.
Thanks so much for that call, Jenny. And I know we just have a few minutes left, and we had a listener request from last time, which would have been Memorial Day, to hear a white-throated sparrow. So let's listen to that quickly. That's a very, very piercing sound.
Yeah, it's really a distinctive song of the North Woods, and people very often put words to songs. And south of the border, it says, "Sam Peabody, 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 Peabody." And, of course, north of the border, it says, "Oh, Canada, 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 Canada."
Of course, you have to localize it for the population. And Bill or Noel, now I'm not remembering which one of you wanted us to play a red-eyed vireo. Also,
I think Bill did.
All right, Bill. Well, here it is. I can only imagine we're driving cats crazy all over the state where there's a radio on nearby.
What I hear there, the common phrase for that is, "Here I am, where are you?" And it's this constant singing. The voice is not that distinct. It sounds kind of robin-like or like a lot of the other common birds, you know, in the voice, but it's the rhythm. And it just goes on and on. And the reason I wanted to have this one for the day is because here's a bird that is very widespread, one of our most common birds in eastern hardwood forests. And just like we mentioned about the indigo bunting, they move up into the canopy of the forest, and they're hard to see. But just listen for that. You'll find they're all over. It's a great way to discover what is really a relatively common bird by voice.
It's a really, it seems like a very rapid cycling of the song, too.
And it continues on and on. He may go on for minutes at a time, and it's just that back and forth rhythm. Here I am. Where are you? Or as I think, kind of ambivalent. What do you think? I don't know. Should we? Maybe not. It just goes back and forth and on and on.
All right.
Someone actually tried to count those in one day, and it was like 30,000 individual little notes that it
wow.
made.
It had to be a slow day for an ornithologist.
Wow. Well, we had a caller ask for me to repeat the name of the organization that I'll be going on the field trips with, and that is the Natural Resources Foundation. It's a great organization. They work to support programming of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. Well, Bill and Noel, again, we are out of time. Always so much fun to spend time with you.
Thanks for having us.
And we're looking forward to Labor Day.
All right. I always make them the same person. Noel Cutright is past president of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Bill Volkert is a naturalist who worked for many years at Horicon Marsh International Education Center. Well, tomorrow at 11, we'll learn all about the science and biology of taste from Barb Stuckey. She wrote Taste What You're Missing, The Passionate Eater's Guide to Why Good Food Tastes Good. And then 11:45, Beatrice Peltre about her newest cookbook. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Thanks for listening.